Vibe
Machine.
Welcome to Undercovers Podcast. I, as always, am your host, Josh Giff. This episode is one I'm really excited about as it features an absolute guru of album design, Mr. Tommy Steele. Now, over the next two episodes, you'll find out all about Tommy, his introduction to art and music art, and you'll discover the stories behind some classic albums. I'm talking Tom Petty's Damn the Torpedoes, Crowded House's self-titled, Neil Young classics including Trans and Everybody's Rockin', The Foo Fighters' The Colour and the Shape, and Poison, Open Up and Say Ah, to name but a few. If you enjoyed this episode, go check out our other episodes and find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Undercovers Podcast. Well, here we go. And we jump straight in, finding out how Tommy got started in music art.
Vibe
Machine.
Well, I ended up going to design school here in Los Angeles at Art Center College of Art and Design when it was here in LA still, before they moved to Pasadena. And I majored in advertising design there. And a lot of my friends were heading down the advertising pathway. Mm. And one summer, I thought, it's got to be a little bit broader view than that. And I applied for a job at a record company. And it was Warner Brothers Records. And basically, that turned into a full-time job. And I left school to kind of start doing that and never looked back.
Wow. Wow. Nice way to start. So many artists that I've chatted to have worked at Warner Brothers or stopped by the Warner Brothers offices on part of their career. It must be a bit of a fertile breeding ground, is it?
It was amazing, actually. I mean, first of all, Ed Thrasher, whose name you may have heard in some of the other people's podcasts, he was the head creative director there. And there's another man named Stan Cornyn, who was also kind of a copywriter and a creative guy, too. And these two guys kind of led the group. I worked under a couple of the art directors there at the time, just, you know, fresh out of school and things. But wow, what an education. It was just everything and anything. But there were some such talented people. Ed and a guy who I work for named Chris Worf both had won numerous Grammys for packaging. They were really great art directors. They knew what it took to kind of create smart advertising and really, you know, conceptual packaging. So that was my best education of all to kind of start me off. Again, impressive time. The freelancers would come in, so I'd get a chance to meet with them and see what they were doing. And that really just opened me up to a much bigger view of what I expected, I think, when I first went in.
Well, it's amazing. Like, not only looking at the artwork that you've done, and I've got a huge list here, especially when you started, but also the era. I mean, you're talking the right in the mid 70s, right through, and that's sort of a really pivotal, important time in the music industry. It was sort of the height of, you know, before that the 80s overexposure came along, and, you know, the MTVs of the world and things like that. This was a real era where, you know, vinyl was king. Artwork on vinyl was really the only form. You know, there was no such thing as video clips, or if there were, they weren't really a big thing. So, you know, artwork was such an important aspect of selling, and you're talking about marketing, of selling the album art. And, you know, looking at some of the stuff that you worked on really early on, I mean, some of the names are incredible. Sly and the Family Stone. I mean, you worked on Heard You Miss Me, Well, I'm Back. What was it like to suddenly be working on, and that's a great album cover, by the way, but what's it like to suddenly be working on acts that I'm sure you grew up listening to?
Well, again, going back even to my early musical influences, my sister was into the Beatles and I was into the Stones, of course.
Nice.
And basically the packaging, my first album that I bought was Let It Bleed with the, you know, all that stuff on the turntable.
Yes.
That a Jimi Hendrix album and a Cream album. So I was kind of looking at interesting art from the word go. And when I think about that, again, just having had a chance to work with some of those artists later on too, I just, sometimes you'd pinch yourself and just go, this is kind of all in your future, but you didn't know it then, you know?
Oh, of course. And when you started, were you similar to a lot of the other artists that I've chatted to, where when you start, you're at the art department and they start by giving you little bits of jobs just to get to ease you in? You know, you might do some typography or some placement and then you slowly build up. Was that how you experienced it?
Exactly the same way.
Right.
They would, you know, it was just the odds and ends and sometimes a little help with design, but some of it would be like they had an in-house pamphlet that they would do monthly. Mm-hmm. And it was the monthly new releases for Warner Brothers. And yeah, I could do the covers of each of those. So they kept seeing some of those being done. And then they would give me a little bit more, give me some ads, and then got to a little bit of packaging before I left there for other places. But again, just the man that I worked for ended up leaving there. And then a new fellow came in, and again, new regime changes. That'll be the story of my career. A lot of different people come and go, but you know, sometimes you're associated with the right group and you can stay a while, and sometimes it doesn't always work out that way.
And that's for everyone in life, sir.
Right.
It doesn't matter what industry you're in. I found that as well. But I mean, so you worked at Warner Brothers, and then I'm assuming you went to Columbia after that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the chronology now. But when you mentioned Sly and the Family Stone, yeah, that was an interesting time because, again, he was a little out of it. But his one-man band, I think, is what the picture of that image is now that I'm remembering. But he lived up in Mandeville Canyon and had a big ranch. And just, you know, again, this, I'm going up there, this kind of blonde surfer kid going up to Sly's ranch. It was kind of bizarre. But again, just I always felt like we wanted to make sure that these artists were heard and that they got the image that they wanted for that particular album, you know, the best that we could help them get there. I never really felt like this is my cover. I always would felt like it's their cover and we're helping you get this accomplished through whatever team of people that we can do that. So in many cases, some of the stuff I look back on, of course, is kind of corny and maybe a little bit too literal. But in a way, at the time, it was a little simpler time. And I think, you know, we've all grown up a little bit more conceptually, and we'll look at a lot more stuff now. We have a lot more stuff to look at. But when you were talking about Warner's and well, even just that era of album cover art, I always liken it to, I would love to go into record stores. And to me, that was a public art gallery. You could go through these albums and look through these racks and just see all the kind of current things that were happening in design, photography, illustration, lettering, whatever. And it was something that kind of reached much further than your desk. And that was what was also impressive, that, yeah, there was no cassettes then. There was only album covers.
Yeah, you got 12 inches. Began. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a big format to fill. But again, and just to see it out there, you'd see it, you know, I'd travel to another country or another state and just realize, well, we worked on this in this little office and it got out there to you know, other eyes. So it was always a kind of a treat to see that happen, because as a designer, you want your stuff to be able to communicate. And I guess communication is about visibility too.
100%. One of the comments I have later on in our chat, but I guess I can mention it now, is I've written down here, at some point in your career, you must have been able to walk into a record shop, look around at sort of the hot albums or the charting albums, and just go, wow, I've worked on a whole bunch of these in any one time in the top 20. And that must have been a pretty great feeling. If, you know, you're talking about being able to walk in record stores and it's like an art gallery, pretty soon you're able to walk in art galleries and it's your art on the wall.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, I think illustrators can say that a little bit more. I've always felt like it was a little like eclectic with my approach to design and even the concepts or the, you know, art directing, if you will. It ends up, the stuff is all over the place in some ways, but I think that's how I think is more broadly that way. From, it could be from the Ultra Lounge work that was a catalog project to a Steve Miller project to a Foo Fighters or a Beastie Boys. I mean, everyone requires a different way to approach their packaging. And I was lucky enough, again, through a lot of these labels, that they weren't just, you know, the rock acts. It was, there was some pop acts. There was a Johnny Mathis. There was Joni Mitchell's. There was you know, catalog work with, you know, people who weren't even alive anymore. So in many ways, it just, you know, we'd had a country label at Capitol. We had Blue Note. So the education musically for me was also wonderful, but also visually, each of these things had a different approach to how we would go about, you know, designing their packaging.
And it's amazing you say that, because I mean, I'm looking at your list of artwork here on Discogs, and it's hundreds and hundreds, I think it's 400 odd. And, you know, the ones that stand out are the names that, I guess when they were out then, they were big, but now they're iconic, like the Flying Burrito Brothers. There's no one left to dry
my... I mean, some of these people, yeah, at the time it was... that particular cover, is that the
Airborne.
One?
It's Airborne.
Yeah. We had done a couple
of
different...
What a great cover.
Well, we'd done a couple of different comps for that, and they were kind of just... We had done, like, basically a United Parcel Express package. It was just brown wrapper tape and some interesting label, and it ends up they had some contact out of this airport between here and Palm Springs called Ruby Doo Airport, and it was just a vintage, you know, single engine plane airport. And we went out there with these guys one day and just, you know, took the photographer, went out there, and those things just kind of happened. So it just, you never know how it, to me, every one of these projects evolves. And again, what you thought initially was going to be the cover sometimes, you know, went way different than you expected. And in a way, I like that, because again, it's a collaboration anyway, and just see where this goes. I'm not too didactic to be able to make this thing, you know, force this down a channel that is not supposed to go. And I've even found that lately in my career too, just to kind of allow this stuff to happen and see where it goes and do the best you can with it. And again, make these artists appreciate who you are and what you're doing for them. But, and again, you're trying to gain their trust so that maybe you have a better chance of doing that the next time around, if that were to ever be the case.
100%. And look, talking about that Flying Burrito Brothers, I love the fact you were talking about that. And for anyone who doesn't know the Airborne cover, it's quite an iconic cover, especially the logo and then the photo of the band outside the plane. But then on the back cover, you've actually got the band inside the plane. And the one thing that I notice about music of that era and artists that era was they didn't have to have that, you know, that look that a lot of bands have, you know, stare at the camera, don't smile, have that intense look. I mean, these guys are in a plane, they're relaxed, they're authentic. Sly Stone on the front of his cover, the one man band, is having a great time. He's authentic. And it's something that of that era that I love that I feel we miss a little bit today.
What I was thinking about when you said that was Ethan Russell photographed The Who's next cover. And right, I love that whole story, because it's just them getting out of the car and going to the side of the road with this thing, and they pee on this thing, and it becomes the thing, right?
Exactly.
So it's kind of capturing the moments where you can, but it was also unstyled, I guess. These people kind of all knew who they were, or most of them do. And that's the hardest thing, I think, is when they don't know who they are, is to try to help figure that out with them. But you ultimately want them to know who they are, both visually, sonically, you know, in every way, shape, or form. But not all of them are that savvy. I mean, I appreciate, you know, like the Talking Heads know who they are, but they went to art school. So I guess that matters, right?
Yes, they had a very clear idea of what they were doing. And, you know, it's great when you've got a whole bunch of very, very smart artists in the one band.
Right. But you were talking about Crowded House. We'll get with Nick Seymour here, but Nick is an artist, as you know.
Yes.
And he spent a lot of time with us at Capitol. We went through quite a bit of packaging with them, but we would, when they'd come to town, we put them up in a house, I guess, to both record the album and get this artwork going. So Nick was by the art department. He's almost like a, you know, an extra designer, illustrator on staff, it felt like at times, because he'd need equipment, he'd need paints, he'd need, you know, send them to the art store or whatever. But those guys were so great and fun to work with, and such incredible music that I was back in that so fondly, you know?
Well, it's amazing. And I had that later on to talk about, but let's talk about it now, because obviously I'm from Australia. Crowded House are one of those iconic Australian bands, even though we poached Neil Finn from New Zealand. So no one really cares about that. He's Australian to us. But you worked on arguably two of their most well-known albums with Nick, which is Temple of Low Men and mm-hmm. then Woodface. And Woodface, both those albums, but Woodface is the first Crowded House album that I bought. And honestly, one of the reasons I bought it, because when it was released, they only had, I think it was the single Chocolate Cake, which everybody hated. And I didn't buy it because of the music. I bought it because of that painting on the front cover. And I went, that is amazing. I've heard the band. I love the artwork. I'm going to buy it. And it's still in my collection today. I still have the CD copy that I bought back in 1989 or 1990, whenever it came out. So it's amazing that you get to talk about, you know, having Nick on hand. And, you know, when you're working with those guys, did you have any idea about, you know, were you listening to the music at the same time you were working with Nick? Did you have much knowledge of Crowded House?
I did through Split Enz. Right, that was my first introduction to them. I had some friends over at A&M that knew that group really well. Mm. And they did some pretty interesting and innovative packaging then. So that was just an earlier incarnation. But again, we tended to get music early. We would hear from the A&R people. They'd give us in those days, probably a blank cassette. I mean, or cassette with the music. Not even a DVD or a CD, but we get the music early or go listen to it with them. So we get a sense of where it's going. And that was always helpful if we had a title and then we could hear some music. And in that case, again, they had a pretty good idea of where they wanted to go, but we did a special deluxe package of that kind of folded open. I don't know if you saw that or so. But,
yes.
But again, we got a chance to kind of take those even further. And that was part of it. That was CDs. We did CDs for, you know, Crowded House at the time, of course. Mm. But to be able to do a promo item that became maybe a saleable possibility was kind of why we'd always do the promotion version of that if we could. Mm. So we kind of got away with that in a couple of cases. If we talk about the Ultra Lounge, we did that as a promo piece that became kind of a retail piece.
Yes.
So, but yeah, like Dennis Keeley is a photographer I used to work with quite a bit on different projects. He shot Tom Petty for me a couple of times. And he also shot that photograph of those guys in Crowded House as well. And we just, again, you know, Paul Hester, I mean, what a crazy guy. I'm sure they all miss him, but was a character.
All of Australia misses him.
Yeah, he was such a character, but just, you know, the lighthearted version. And these three guys were just like, you know, Three Musketeers, if you will.
Yes.
Just a good group. And it just seemed like solid to me. It just, you know, things don't always stay, you know, stay solid.
No, but the good news is that they have reformed. I went and saw them a few years ago. They did a Farewell to the World outside the Sydney Opera House. And then they came back and they did. And I missed that. I was doing my HSC, my end of school certificate on the day that was on. So I missed it. Back in the day, I was 18. And then they came back a couple of years ago and they reenacted it. They did it again. So I got to go and got to meet the band. It was amazing. It was just an incredible thing. And they're coming back out again next year. Obviously, Neil Finn these days is part of Fleetwood Mac, which is interesting and exciting in a way. And, you know, and he gets to play Crowded House songs every night and Split Enz songs. And now he gets to bring the band back up, which is just great.
But that'll be fantastic. We have good memories of that. One of the presidents of Capitol just loved these guys. And we would go up to Santa Barbara to see them. We'd see them down here with some of the label people, and myself would go and see them wherever we could, because it was just that much fun, really. And their music has really held up well over the years. I just love those guys and that music.
Oh, half their songs are like Australian anthems out here.
I mean, you can sing them, you can hum them. Yeah. They have great lyrics. They're smart. They're just melodic. They're hooky. It's just all that stuff, right?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And someone else that is melodic and hooky. And I mean, I play guitar very badly, but if I put three chords together, I'm playing a Tom Petty song. There is no doubt. I say, even before Tom Petty passed away, any song that came on, I'm like, that's a ripoff of Tom Petty. I would say it to my kids constantly till they got to know Tom Petty songs. You know, my kids are really young. But you, sir, worked on Damn the Torpedoes. Arguably, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. I have a 1979 radio promo copy in my hands that I tracked down of that one. So I was like, I'm not going to buy the original pressing. I'm not only going to get the original pressing, I'm going to get a radio pressing of it. So I managed to find one. And it's got the Backstreet sticker on the front and not for sale, and I'm holding it in my hands right now. And that album cover, you know, when you start working with Tom Petty, and this was a really interesting time in his young career. He just fought the record label for the rights to his catalog, publishing rights, and he'd won. And it, you know, this album had been delayed a long time. What was it like around that time working with Tom and putting together that album?
Well, here's my big story with this whole project. It's kind of pivotal in my life.
Mm.
Tom came to Backstreet. Backstreet Records was an offshoot of MCA Records, where I was at the time. It was on the lot. It was on the Universal lot at the time, but it was a little sub-label they gave to the head of, trying to describe this. Danny Bramson was the head of the amphitheater at the time. The amphitheater was our open air outside, you know, amphitheater on Universal lot that, you know, had big acts coming through.
Amazing.
So Danny, they ended up somehow gave him this label when Tom, when he came on to MCA, they gave Danny this label and said basically Tom was heading it up, and they added other people to it after that. But we had to design the Backstreet logo for them and just literally everything from the ground up. At the Tom Petty listening party for Dartmouth Torpedoes, I met my current wife. That's where I met Fiona, and she was working for Danny at Backstreet. We had met in kind of, you know, over just through office dealings, but that was our first date, and that was a pretty big first date. So we go way back there. I mean, that's such an important thing in our lives.
Out of all first dates, Tommy, you win.
Yeah, that was a pretty good one. So
love it.
Yeah, it was an amazing time. Again, Tom, I worked with him on 5 albums after that. I don't know if I think I left there fairly soon after that project, maybe. But I went freelance for a little while and got a chance to work with him on, you know, the succeeding packages. And I don't know, just for me, yeah. His first album was amazing that we didn't do, of course.
Yes.
John Kosh, I think, had a hand in that one that you've spoken to before. But
he did.
But this one, yeah, just kind of launched him in a different way. And again, our lives intersected with many ways, and, you know, went to his house quite a bit, you know, knew Jane Petty, knew him before he had his kids. And just, you know, it's just amazing to kind of see that whole process happen and see him grow and see it launch. Because you weren't sure. I mean, it sounded really good to us, but you don't really ever know if these things really connect. And this one just connected.
And it's interesting because the first album sort of blew up in the UK before it blew up in America. It sort of really didn't blow up in America. It's now their radio staples, but it's, they, you know, it wasn't this huge thing. Tom Petty wasn't all over the radio on that first album, but Damn the Torpedoes, I mean, the minute he released Refugee, it was, and Don't Do Me Like That, it was all over. Everyone knew his songs. And like you said about Crowded House, they're hummable, they're singable. They come on the radio and everyone knows every word. And every note, you know, that Mike Campbell's playing on guitar, you know it. It's just part of the world fabric now. But it's fascinating. And putting that together with Tom, was he instrumental in, you know, the cover art and the photography and making sure that, you know, the band were present on the back cover? And was that something that you would sit down with him and work through?
You know what? It was a little hands-off on that particular album. It was interesting because we had shown him, in those days, we didn't have, you know, computer printouts or PDFs. We had to kind of actually make a physical print. And we made a color stat is what it was called, a color, just kind of a fairly cheap print. And that was, we comped it up. Well, we ended up making proofs of this thing, and the proof came in and we showed it to him. And he ended up saying that he thought he looked too tan. So he said, you know, where was that comp that you showed us? We ended up going back to the comp and scanning, or whatever we did in those days, scanned that. And that ended up becoming the colorized version of what you saw. Because he just thought he looked too, you know, he didn't want to look too retouched or anything. And it wasn't retouched per se, but it was cleaned up and just color corrected. And he didn't like that. He just wanted it to be as undone as possible.
Love it. I love it. And it's one of those albums, and it's one of those ones that you do walk in. I always feel if I walk into a record store and I see Damn the Torpedoes on a wall, I know I'm in the right place because they're going to have great music. And, you know, this album cover is just Red and Tom, and it just is perfect in every way. And you mentioned you worked on 5 albums with him. And like you said, I've chatted to John Koch and I've chatted with Jerry Hyden, who I know you mm-hmm. know, everyone knows Jerry. And she worked on a lot of his later albums, and she sort of looks after his box sets now that he's passed away. But you got to work on The Iconic. I mean, if I could pick any era and any artist to work on, you know, one of them would be Tom Petty, Damn the Torpedoes, Hard Promises, Southern Accents, Long After Dark. I mean, and you did Pack Up the Plantation, and I think you did a couple of others.
Mm-hmm.
What, I mean, Southern Accents is just iconic, and the one that I love is Hard Promises. The fact you managed to get Tom looking natural, I think it's in a record store, isn't it?
It's in a record store downtown LA that Joel Bernstein photographed, and then he hand-tinted that. That's a black and white picture that he hand-tinted.
Wow.
And we ended up having to retouch in that 898 on that. It wasn't, of course, there, but, you know, subtly in that corner, you can kind of see the 898, because Tom, at the time, they were trying to get him to go to a 998
yes.
you know, retail yes. price, but yep. it's 898 on that cover, so...
There you go. I love it. I love it. And once again, it's just that easygoing, natural look that, you know, that suits him and suits the band and it suits the era as well. It's just, and it almost sets the era in a way. And then, you know, once again, then you start working on his other albums and, you know, you did the You Got Lucky single, Long uh-huh. After Dark with the red overlay, which just looks incredible as well. And, you know, what was your favorite one to work on with Tom or without Tom? What was your favorite Tom Petty design that you love still?
Wow. Well, it's interesting because the Southern Accents came about in a really weird way too. He, for the first time, didn't want to be on the cover. And it was kind of an odd thing because everyone, of course, wanted him to be on the cover, either yes. with or without the band. And he had this idea about this, it was just called Southern Accents. I think it was called something else before. I don't know if that was the first title of it, but he was definitely focusing on that. And that ended up becoming the title. He had me look around for, is there any existing paintings or artwork that is out there? And I don't know. Honestly, I don't even remember how I came to find this Winslow Homer painting for him, but he just loved it. And it was just kind of, I look at it now and think, well, was that the right image for that? I mean, it resonates because of maybe we've seen it, but, you know, I don't think it was a Southern painting per se. Mm. And that whole tour was all about, you know, the Confederate flag and this whole thing that, of course, now he's had to, at the latter part of his career, he had to somewhat, you know, apologize and
distance himself, yes.
Yeah, just from his lack of, you know, being as familiar with that as he needed to be.
Yes,
but,
yes.
You know, that was still what he grew up with, so it wasn't the wrong thing, but it did evolve.
It was a different time. I mean, as you're working on Tom Petty, and it's great that I've got to ask you about Tom Petty, but sort of, in a way, it's sort of intertwined. You'd sort of do one Tom Petty looking at your career, and then you'd do a Neil Young album cover.
And I was so, just going to go to Neil, too. He's the same kind of an artist who just is... you know, kind of simpler, like Everybody's Rockin', for instance. We met him. He had this idea for this rockabilly album, and we met him at Nudie's in North Hollywood. Nudie's is that rodeo tailor that used to do things for Graham Parsons and awesome. Whatever. He was having a suit made there. He was getting fitted for this suit to make sure it was fitting. And we went across the street to this little hole in the wall that ended up being kind of a porn store or something. I don't know. It was some really weird thing in North Hollywood, but it was an empty room. We ended up putting some fabric in the background, I think, as the backdrop. You can kind of see it in the photo,
yes,
but
yes.
Again, Dennis Keeley shot that with me. We just went there, met with Neil, shot that stuff right there across the street. And he was gone within like 2 hours.
That's amazing.
And just, Yeah, those kinds of things. Or for Old Ways, we went up to his ranch up in Northern California, and just, you know, kind of got to go up there and see where he lived and how he lived. And
did you get to meet the old man?
Exactly. But no, you know, one of the amazing things about going up there was his son, Ben, is severely handicapped, as you probably know. But he had built this barn. I mean, Neil is a huge Lionel train collector. Mm. And I think he's even on the board of Lionel. But he had built a barn with all of his train sets in here that his son Ben could operate kind of by like a joystick he could control with his mouth.
Wow.
And it was insane. It was like this whole barn was filled with the biggest train sets you've ever seen. I mean, on tracks and just going through tunnels and through landscapes, and just really a special place that he tried to create for his son. So seeing that was just, again, it makes you realize these people, you know, this son couldn't have been born to a better man to help, you know, take care of him.
Look, and it's something about Neil Young, and I've become a Neil Young fan. I'm 41, and I've become a Neil Young fan sort of early 30s, mid 30s onwards. You know, I sort of didn't really get into him that when I was that young, and now I just, everything I hear about him, every interview I see, everything that he does is just so, once again, authentic. But it's just, he doesn't give a crap what anybody else thinks. He's got his own way of doing stuff, and he's like, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but this is who I am and this is how I operate. And, you know, you're talking about trains and things there and sort of movement. And the first album I think you worked on of his was Trans. Is that correct?
It was. That was one of them. I'm trying to remember what the first one was. But, yeah, again, we had worked with him to try to get his vision for this thing. And he had this idea that he wanted something futuristic on the front, and like the man kind of going from this past to the future.
Yes.
And this amazing artist, Barry Jackson, who I had known, I got him to kind of sketch up some things. We showed Neil, he kind of got the sketch and off and running again. I think the collage with the heart came from something that some contact that he had. I didn't art direct that part of it. Mm-hmm. But again, it was like, this guy, talk about eclectic, right? I mean, he will try everything and anything. Mm. And he's just one of those guys that, as you said, he'll just try it and see if it works and move on to the next. I mean, from the rockabilly to this kind of you know, futuristic thing, to Old Ways, to whatever. Again, you're talking about, my influence with him was in high school, everyone in the talent shows tried to imitate either James Taylor or Neil Young. So, you know, those are the songs where people would sing and get up and play their songs. So when you're there, like with this guy who, you know, did Harvest and some of those kinds of things, you just go, God, this is crazy time.
And it's just, it's incredible, isn't it? I also get into James Taylor these days as well. So, you know, it's that era is sort of coming back, especially for people. And that's what I love about album art is that, and music in general, you can go back and you can appreciate things from the 60s and 70s now. One of my favorite bands is Big Star, and the Big Star story is iconic and everything, but I absolutely love Big Star, and I didn't get into them until 5 or 10 years ago as well. But
on their label right now. I work at Concord, and yeah, they're re-releasing some of their stuff on vinyl right now.
So, big fan too. You are speaking my language. I will send you a photo, and everyone who listens into this podcast, I do put my photos up on my socials a little bit. I have a whole billiard table room, and I don't play pool, so it doesn't have a table in there. And it's got wall-to-wall covered vinyl, and I've got a whole wall with Big Star and all of it signed by Alex Chilton and Jody Stevens. And John Fry, I wrote to Jody Stevens, and right before John Fry died, about a week before he died, he signed all my vinyl, and Jody sent it back to me. And
that's incredible, Josh.
I know, and I have this, and it's on my wall, and I don't let any sunlight on it, and my wife yells at me, and and it sits next to all of this really rare stuff that Robert Fisher sent me from the Nirvana days. So it's just like, and I've got it, and I was talking off air, everyone. We've got bushfires around where I am, and I literally took photos and video of everything, and I just said to my wife, I could never take this off the wall in enough time. So I've had fun collecting it. And if it goes up in smoke, it it goes up in smoke and I'll shed a tear and move on.
Well, I'm a collector of a lot of stuff and have, you know, quite a bit of vinyl and quite a bit of CDs and all of my artwork and things like that over the years. And these recent fires in LA were the same thing for me. So we were packed up and ready to go, but I could not possibly take everything. And if that was to happen, I'm with you.
Yep. I just went, oh, well, I shrugged my shoulders and my wife's like, what are you talking about? You spent 20 years collecting these. I'm like, what can I do? Nothing I can do as long as we're all safe.
We're all collectors, though, and I do love that. We were mentioning Neil. I mean, one of my favorite covers was Zuma. To mention that Rick Griffin designed that logo that was on that cover as well, or that typography. Wow. So, I mean, just from that, you know, almost Dada-esque, cover art, it's so great that, you know, he explored a lot of different things. So I always felt like we had a big, tall order to kind of have to do something interesting or whatever. But again, as you were saying before, you know, this is just, it kind of evolves and each of these projects are their own thing. And you hope to have it be iconic, but that isn't ever the plan. It sometimes happens in hindsight.
Oh, it's the ones you don't expect that become the iconic one. But the thing, before I move off Trans, the thing I love about Trans is it was released in 1982 and it's got elements of Back to the Future with the DeLorean. Doesn't get released for four or five more years. And it's got elements of Tron, which doesn't come out for another 12 months. It's got a picture of a Concorde. I think it's a Concorde jet in the sky. So Lawrence Azarad, one of our other artists, he will be loving that because he did a big book on the Concorde and he's a huge flight fan. So, you know, it's finding the artist that you found that you mentioned and having this as the album cover. It's talking about the past and that car looks exactly like Neil Young's car. He has a car that looks exactly like that on the right hand side.
The photograph on the inside of that sleeve is him in his, you know, Cadillac holding that guitar. So yeah, he was a huge car buff, as you know.
Yes.
But he would try and get things like that in there. So some of this comes from someone, again, who knows who they are, what they like, and those kinds of influences can be had. I'm always surprised that artists don't want to do that more, that they don't have like, let's go have some fun with this. Why do you just need to have a photograph with some type on it to sell your album? Why can't you have it say something, mean something more than, and have the fans find something to look at? Rather than just something like a publicity photo with type on it.
And, you know, I feel like that's coming back into vogue with a lot of the younger artists. There's a new band, well, they're not new anymore, and they're very huge. They're called 21 Pilots. And the artist who does all of their artwork, his name's Brandon Reich. And he's someone who literally has looked at the past and gone, you know what, these things worked. Having that extra detail in the artwork and little Easter eggs people can find, which is what you're talking about, having all of those elements, you know, the kids these days are obsessed with 21 Pilots, and part of it is because of the artwork. It fits, it suits the music, it enhances the music and enhances the story. And there was a time period where that was lacking. And now I love the fact that it's coming back. You know what I mean?
Well, when you design things for fans, I think it matters. I think these 21 Pilots realizes that. But again, there's an artist who really, he knows who he is. Mm. I think the videos are clever. You know, their whole visual presentation is important, from the stage show to the videos to the packaging. I think you can go into depth there these days. I mean, with the resurgence of vinyl here in LA, if nowhere else, I mean, it's just crazy how much, you know, special colored vinyl, special packaging, kind of happening again. It's in limited quantities, which is for the collectors and fans is the perfect thing, but it's 100%. Not selling like the, you know, the million units that Michael Jackson was, but so be it.
But, and you know, they get thrown into recycled bins and, you know, people sell them. I mean, I have a philosophy, I collect memorabilia and I will never sell anything. I don't sell anything. I feel like I've cheapened it if I sell it. So my house is full of it. My wife keeps it very, very, very contained. But I wanted to move from there to another iconic cover. And this one's a bit of a different one. I wanted your take on it. It was, and it's from a movie as well, which is John Lennon's Imagine. Now, I walk into a record store and I see that album cover, and I feel like the album version of that artwork, which is the drawing of John Lennon, has stood up better than the movie. I hardly ever see the movie artwork, even though it's the same thing, but I hardly ever see it on the front of a DVD or anything. But anytime I walk in a record store and you go to the Beatles or Lennon, that's there.
Well, we got to work with him a few times in this job that I had at a place called Art Hotel with Chris Wharf, who was from Warner Brothers. We worked on Double Fantasy for Yoko, and I did a book with Yoko after John passed as well. This one, though, to be honest, I believe it was the artwork that came from the movie poster. Mm. So we didn't have a whole lot to do with that other than just trying to make this package fit work and feel appropriate. So, yeah, I just wish I could say a little bit more, but no, I think that one was pretty amazing illustration, though.
Oh, and you mentioned that you got to work on Double Fantasy. Everywhere it's getting better and better. Must have been an incredible time, because
it was so beyond belief time. I mean, we went through it all, because we got this record together, and then he died, and then it just became this other thing afterwards, and just, oh my God, it was pretty heartbreaking all that went on for us too. But again, just these incredible photographs of them. It was just, it almost felt like his last album when you look back at it now, too. You know, you look at it like, did they know? Did he know? Did he sense anything? I don't know. It's always looked a little prescient to me.
Well, it's weird, isn't it? Because people try and delve into things. They try and make something that isn't there, such as, you know, did they know? You know, he's on a street front on the back cover.
Yeah.
You know, was that a sign that he was going to, you know, that it was going to happen outside the Dakota building? And, you know, of course it wasn't. It was his life, and he lived and he worked around there. So, you know, he and Yoko were just so inseparable. It fits. But, I mean, being able to be part of that time period in that era must have been incredible, Tom. We like, did you work primarily with Yoko before?
I did. As a matter of fact, and afterwards, she, for this book project, I went back to visit her and talk about this and get the photographs and things. And she needed to know my astrological sign before she would let me come back there.
Wow. So
she needed all that information at the time. She's a little quirky, but again, she knew what she wanted and how to portray this. And she still does. I mean, what an artist, right? Yeah. I mean, I think in looking over her career, she was a conceptualist. She had ideas that not everyone may have espoused, but she really was a true artist. So, she protected his legacy pretty strongly too over the years, but I was lucky to, you know, just work a little bit with her.
And it's amazing. You know, I've chatted with John Kosh, who was instrumental in that last era of the Beatles, and then instrumental in the look and feel of how John and Yoko portrayed themselves in The War Is Over and the sleep-ins and all of that. He was right there. He was sort of helping manufacture the look and feel. You know, and he spoke a lot about Yoko, and, you know, she knew, like you said, she knew exactly what she wanted. She had ideas and she had philosophies that at the time people thought were weird, but now they're starting to realize that she was just a little bit ahead of the curve.
Yeah. No, she really was had a wonderful philosophy and a kind of a holistic view of the world even then. Mm. We would get Christmas cards from her, and it just was always uplifting, always kind of spiritual. And I think that was a good influence on John, if nothing else. Just, wow, big loss though, huh?
The biggest loss in music history, unfortunately. But John Lennon did leave us with sort of an instruction manual of how to be a true pop and rock craftsman. Well, that's part one of our chat with Tommy Still in the Can. And you wouldn't believe one person could be responsible for so much iconic imagery in the music world. Stunning. Next episode, we hit the 80s right through to Tommy's recent work. And you won't believe what this gentleman is responsible for. I'm talking Poison, Blind Melon, Megadeth, Foo Fighters, and more. So tune in and check out our other episodes as well. Thanks, and bye for now. Vibe Machine.